I'm amazed. We are actually absolutely on time. My name is Dennis Altman. I come from Australia. I'm an academic and a writer, and most importantly for this conference, one of the patrons of the Australian Lesbian and Gay Archives. My role is really to be a timekeeper and to try and keep a discussion going. But I do want to make one comment, which is it is absolutely wonderful that on the eve of Stonewall, which seems to have taken over the entire global discussion about homosexuality, we actually have come together to talk about movements in three very different countries with very different histories. And I'm thrilled at the turn-up for such a diverse group of presentations. I'm not going to read out the biographies of the people presenting because they're all in the program book along the abstracts. So I'm just going to ask the speakers one by one to present. I'll ask them to come to the front so everyone can see and hear them. And then there should be lots of time for both questions and discussions. So Hans, I guess, ask you to come forward and start us off. I give you the spot places with Frankel. And we'll just move on. I'm really sorry if people have come in late. I don't think we can do anything. We obviously are the most popular panel in the program, which is great, but I'm not going to suggest we storm the stage. We're going to have to deal with the problems of this room.
Okay. I could stand also. Better. So, hello to everybody again. Thank you for attending this panel. I will talk about the question or controversy of a potential memorialization of an unsung anti-fascist hero. At the beginning, I will try to tell you the story of this remarkable person whose photo actually we do not have, at least for now. I still haven't been able to find one. So this is just a generic illustration from the Second World War in Yugoslavia. And then at the end, I would give you a couple of my ideas, remarks, and also concerns about the problems of memorializing this person. At the beginning, just a little bit of the general context for all of you that are not familiar with the Balkan history. So in April 1941, following the Axis invasion of the Kingdom of Yugoslavia, Serbia was occupied by Nazi Germany, Montenegro came under Italian control, Croatia became a puppet state, Quisling state, and annexed Bosnia. Immediately after that, the leader of the Communist Party of Yugoslavia, Josip Broz Tito, called for an uprising against the occupation. By the end of 1941, the resistance movement had ignited in parts of Croatia and Bosnia-Herzegovina, so the things in not clear red, because of course the uprising was moving shrinking and enlarging its liberated territory, and the heart of the resistance, officially known as National Liberation Movement, consisted of several thousand partisan fighters scattered throughout Yugoslavia, mostly pre-war communists and members of the youth wing of the party. This core of Yugoslav anti-fascists was supposed not only to lead the uprising, but also to clear the way for a post-war socialist revolution. This meant their behavior in all spheres of life became of the most utter importance. Communist leaders would often repeat how important self-control was, listing all kinds of virtues to be found in the communists, such as self-sacrifice, modesty, discipline, vigilance, and sexual respectability. The importance of firmness and sternness in the private life of a communist was constantly emphasized in the underground press already before the war, for example. So, however, this Puritan sexual code has a specific political purpose. It serves as a shield from the many innuendos made by political enemies that portrayed communists as hypocrites and debauchers. In the interwar period, European conservative and fascist political movements attempted to contain the Bolshevik revolutionary turmoil within Soviet borders by, for instance, also depicting communists as sexual offenders, libertines, promoters of free love, and destroyers of the traditional family. In order to defend themselves against such accusations, communist organizations carefully watched over their members' sexual and private life. Moreover, in their efforts toward the revolutionary transformation of society, Yugoslav communists were expected to provide a role model for the masses. Masculinity, moral impeccability and sexual decency, and the fighting strength of soldiers, officers and heroes of the war became items of national awareness and patriotic concern. Josip Mardešić, and this is the name of our unsung hero, a 20-year-old native of Komiža, that's a small town on the Adriatic island of Vis, joined the Yugoslav anti-fascist movement in January 1942, so immediately after just a couple of months of the uprising. Carrying only a radio transmitter he had previously stolen from the Italian fascists. After a security check and admittance in the Communist Party, he was given false identity papers and embarked on a passenger steamer headed to Split, the main city in Dalmatia, and soon reached the liberated territory, so the mountainous region in inner Croatia. At that time, under the control of the liberation movement and also the home of the Central Committee of the Communist Party and of the general staff of the uprising anti-fascist army. At the time, a competent wireless operator was needed, and Mardešić had a valuable expertise in this field because just a few years earlier he had served as a sergeant and wireless operator in the Royal Navy of the occupied, now occupied Kingdom of Yugoslavia. So he received orders to begin setting up radio connections, he started developing a coding system, he soon earned the reputation of an expert, and in late 1942 his superiors nominated him chief communication officer of the whole uprising army. This position made him a member of the army general staff, so very high position, and he was immediately promoted to the rank of captain as his first officer rank, so he skipped a lot of ranks and immediately captain. As chief communication officer, he was responsible for a confidential and highly sensitive task. He managed and supervised technical work, trained new communication officer and so on, and commanded the whole resistance army's communication network. However, he kept a delicate secret from his superiors and other partisans. Whenever he had the opportunity, he scheduled his working shift so that he could work alongside a few of his favorite soldiers. He tried to keep a low profile and avoid the attention from the rest of the of his fellow fighters, probably feeling all along that his homosexual relations would not go unpunished. And he was right, because when he was discovered, a sudden and dramatic series of events ensued. The general staff was informed of his homosexuality in the last days of February 44. It remains unknown who denounced him or how he was exposed. Initially, the suggestion as to how he should be punished involved nothing harsher than reprimand, stripping of his rank and expulsion from the party. However, since he was an important member of the general staff and a high-ranking officer, for the first couple of days, the entire matter was handled in secrecy, as everyone involved waited for the final decision by the leaders of the party. He was finally brought in front of the Partisan Army Court of Honor. During the trial, Captain Mardešić partially confessed that he had had homosexual relations with his subordinates. His sexual partners, however, gave complete confession, as is quoted in the documents. This military tribunal stripped him of his rank, pronounced a judgment on his whole persona by declaring him sick, twisted, selfish, and a cowardly man, and sentenced him to death. The sentence was carried out 3 days later. The verdict was delivered in accordance with the ordinance on the courts of honor for the officers of the National Liberation Army. You have this is a partial of the judgment. The role of these tribunals was to watch over the comportment, reputation, and manners of the officers. There were three possible penalties: deposition, stripping of rank, and execution. So he was punished with the most harsh one, the death. So the verdict found that by, quote, indulging in his unhealthy lust, he stained the honor of all the officers of the People's Army. He was also found guilty for having seduced his subordinates to unhealthy sexual relations by exploiting their dependent position and youthful innocence. He was 26, and his subordinates were 23, 22, and 21. So, youthful innocence. thus causing irreparable damage to their normal development. The verdict displays a wide array of mechanisms that define the homosexual man as an unhealthy person whose actions could be tracked back to his perverted sexual inclinations. He was, Mladičić was not only guilty for having committed a specific homosexual act or acts, on trial was also his weak character that, quote, tends to perpetrate all sorts of crimes for personal gain. He is described as insincere and cowardly. Homosexuality is portrayed as a stain on the military honor and an act of shameful betrayal of the nation's confidence. His behavior is described as having a destabilizing effect on the military morale, since this sexual conduct afflicted, quote, his working skills in a way described by the judges as sabotage. So apart from being a symbolic traitor of the nation's confidence, the homosexual is here also an active saboteur, because by indulging his sexual needs, he sabotages the war effort. At least that was what they tried to prove. So the verdict emphasizes three key elements: the sexual corruption of the youth, the perversity and immorality of the egoistic and anti-socialist homosexual personality, and the insult this represents to both the nation and the army. So this is the historical account on Captain Mladičić, one of the few homosexuals executed in a legal procedure in 20th century Europe. So we don't have, at this point of historical research, many examples of death sentences for homosexuality. We do have in paralegal procedures, so without a proper judgment, without a proper sentence, without a proper tribunal, and there are many of them. But complete, full legal, and this is the full the transcription, no, the original, the copy of the original document, and there's also something on the second page. We have just a few, as far as I'm informed, in the whole of 20th century Europe, and this is the only one known in the Yugoslav region. In the last couple of years, I have extensively researched Captain Mladičić's life and his tragic end, and presented my findings at conferences, journals, and books. But apart from documenting and recounting his story, there is another crucial aspect to my research, the one that aims to establish a collective public memory of this unsung anti-fascist queer hero. Had he survived the war, he would most probably, as did his colleagues, become a highly ranking military officer, a general, or probably a politician, as was the case with most post-Second World War Yugoslav anti-fascist heroes. So in front of him, most probably he would have a great career. But this aspect of how to establish a collective public memory of this unsung anti-fascist queer hero, both in the post-Yugoslav LGBT community, in national historical narrative, and why not in an international context, since we don't have so many examples of executed high-ranking officers that actually had so important roles in the anti-fascist struggle. Had he survived the war, he would most certainly, as I said, become a highly decorated hero, but he did not survive the war. The question is how, the main concern is how, taking into consideration the contemporary political and social context in Europe and especially in post-Yugoslav countries such as Slovenia, Croatia, Serbia, and Bosnia, how to proceed with the memorialization of this person. The first step is maybe already completed, and that was the official historicization of Captain Mladičić's military anti-fascist achievement and his tragic end. I published, as I said, my findings, but through contacts in the Croatian academia, I proposed a biographical entry on him to be put in a Croatian biographical lexicon. It's a prominent publication, both online and in paper, edited by the National Lexicographical Institute. It seems, we will see by the end of the year, that Mladičić will get an entry, yes, maybe by the end of the year, in the National Biographical Lexicon. Now, the challenge is how to memorialize him. So the historization process on institutional and academic level, I think, has been completed. The main risk comes from the anti-communist, anti-fascist, and anti-socialist revisionist trends very strong in the post-Yugoslav countries. The far right already used the fact that homosexuality was criminalized in the socialist Yugoslavia until 1977 to criticize the contemporary LGBT movement for being leftist, sometimes cynically pointing out that gay and lesbians are the only minority celebrating their oppressors, which is, of course, absurd. They, of course, choose to ignore that same-sex relations were criminal offenses also in many parts of the democratic and liberal West, not to speak about fascist and Nazi countries, and throughout the 20th century. The persecution of homosexuals in socialism is also conveniently used to emphasize the repressive nature of communism as such, by arguing that communists persecuted everyone, including homosexuals. So the popularization of the death sentence and the tragic end of Josip Mardešić would only add fuel to such revisionist discourse and would not help the cause of his rightful memorialization. Because they would say, yes, of course, the savage communists, anti-fascists, of course, they are savages, so they killed everyone they would encounter. Of course, they would choose to ignore the fact that Mardešić's partners and sexual partners and subordinates were all left alone. So they were stripped of their ranks and maybe expelled from the party, but that was it. No one was sentenced to death. My idea is to first try to engage the local LGBTIQ community. This should happen not so much with public lectures, brochures, and articles, and in queer press, but maybe by artistic intervention and performances. And now I'm open for your suggestions and ideas about how to proceed. Thank you.
Okay. Franco, you're the first person I've chaired to this conference where I didn't need to wave the time sign, so thank you.
No one is perfect, so.
Well, I'm very tempted to explain that you're not perfect, but I won't. But I will ask Christian and Ole now to come and present on Denmark.
Yeah. So, it is not Christian. He is Ole. I am Christian Petersen.
How do I
I'm married
get
to Ole,
out of this?
And we are going to tell you a story about how the gay liberation has been started in Denmark.
I don't know how to get out of this.
You don't
No, no.
Technical support, perhaps?
Like this?
Yeah. And we have been reading a book which we are not finished to deliver because it has not been printed. But all the work is done. And we have it. We have made an overhead here, and Ole will present that, and I will keep quiet. Well,
it doesn't work like it should. We see the. Just a moment.
You have to press this one.
No, but I'll have to find the. Bildschirm Präsentation.
Yep.
Yeah. There.
And then to the left.
Then to the left?
Yeah. From the beginning on.
Put it on.
Ah, here. No.
Try to.
So.
And where to continue? Where?
No, here.
You see? So
Will we start now?
Well, we have been starting when you were doing that. You are going to present what we have done to write the book.
Yeah.
And Ole shall do all the main presentations. And afterwards, we will be asking questions. So you can go on, Ole.
Yeah, good. Our book is on Bøssernes Befrielsesfront, that's to say the Copenhagen Gay Liberation Front. And about the founding of BBF, as we call it, it happened in 1971. On Sunday, 17th June 1971, there was the first Danish commemoration ever of Stonewall Riot. In 28 June 1969. This first commemoration was organized in Copenhagen by the existent gay rights movement F48, now LGBT Denmark. And next day, Monday 28th June, in the evening we had the first meeting of a group called Bøsseaktivisterne, gay activists. And ever since the organization had been meeting at every Monday evening. And in summer 1971, already we had the first actions of Bøsseaktivisterne at Fælledparken, a big park in Copenhagen, during beat concerts that was organized every Sunday afternoon there. And in autumn 1971, we had dance actions at Rådhuspladsen Town Hall Square in Copenhagen, in diverse gay bars and other. And about the first manifestation at beat concert, we simply sat upon the public, the rest of the public, with our banner saying, "The gays are here too," and here you see a photo from it. Bøsserne er her også, in Danish. And the others accepted us as the way as we were. No problem. The first dance action at Copenhagen City Hall Square, it took place in October 1991, and we have a picture from a newspaper the next day with this text below that says, "About 20 homosexuals demonstrated yesterday afternoon at City Hall Square against authorities' prohibition of same-sex dancing at public places." That was one of our first actions. And our book contains four chapters. The first chapter is about the first years, 1972 to 74, and we now named ourselves Bøssernes Befrielsesfront, as to say Gay Liberation Front, or BBF. This was the year with the first actions and seminars. The great years, the next chapter, from 1975 to 77, where we had major gay camps in Jutland. We'll talk about that later. And the later years, from 1978 to 83, we had the last political actions with the descending rate. And then we have a final chapter called BBF and the Culture, from 1984 till this day. The gay house at Christiania, called Bøssehuset, became a venue for theater, cabarets, and the like. And you see here my t-shirt with Christiania. It means keep Christiania going. The first year, the first year, years involved, and you have here a quick survey, that we were few participants, 10 to 25 at most. We had our first internal seminars in 1972 and 73 with discussions on ideology and form of actions. For instance, dance actions against prohibition of same-sex dancing at public places, and this prohibition was abolished in 1973. We participated at the two great external seminars in 1972 at Aarhus, the second city of Denmark, on sexual politics. The first seminar in May was with German sex researcher Raimund Reiche, maybe you have heard of him. And the second seminar in September included dance actions at bars, where many of the members were beaten and came to hospitals. And we had an internal meeting in Milan in October 1972 with the Italian gay group Fuori and the French gay group Far. And we published important literature for our members, such as Danica and Reiche report on German gays, Karl Wittmann gay manifesto, and Henning Beck texts on gay repression. We give two examples of actions. The 5th March 1973, a group of active members present BBF and our politics and form of actions in a radio program, which was published later in a book called Men, the Weakened Sex. And on 5th March 1974, BBF participated in a communal election with Gaylist and Christianus United Group Valpo, which means something like election castle. And at the same time, there's this a hint at the female name, Valpo. And about the Roman radio program and communal election, we can see here the front page of the book, Men, the Weakened Sex, was like that list, with many other articles and interviews. And our communal election poster from 74 looked like this. About the great years, 1975 to 77, we call them the great years because we then were many participants, 50 and more. And we celebrated Christopher Street Liberation Day every year. And in summer, so we had summer camps in Thy, organized by Det Nye Samfund, the New Society, is an association of left-wing groups. And we had break camps there in 76 and 77. And we had basis groups to discuss more a smaller group. And we had seminars and schooling, and we had a so-called gay caravan. About Christopher Street Liberation Day 1975, we can tell that the manifestation was held together with lesbian movement and traditional F48 on 21st of June through Copenhagen, it ending in Fælledparken. And the same year was published the first record called Bøsse, which is gay in Danish, by Bent Jacobsen. And here you see the cover of the record. And it was, there were many songs with gay themes. I could have brought an example, but we don't have time for this.
I'm really worried, to be honest. You don't have time for a lot of it.
Yeah, okay. In summer camp 1976, we were 100 gays from all over Europe. And there were gays from Denmark, Sweden, Norway, and Germany, like Harvey and others, but also from the Netherlands and others. And we had a sexual seminar for camp in general, and here you see a picture from the camp with two of our so-called feminists. Yeah. So went inspired by the Harvey. And there was a board for heteros in camp in German, saying schwul ist schön. In English, gay is good. And below, at party today, you can see this. And tomorrow you may confirm it yourself. And below was a sign saying, "Now you now leave heterosexual sector in 5 languages." A typical activity in gay camp you can see here, BBF activists making themselves pretty, putting nail polish in different colors at the camp fireplace. And it's me at right with the red shirt. Now, many years ago. We had other important activities, like basis groups with about five members, for all members in order to discuss more freely and detailed than at general meetings. And we had weekend seminars to discuss politics and activities more thoroughly. and we had schooling programs aiming at better political consciousness. And the so-called gay caravan was a group of PBFs traveling around Denmark with a theater play, a street theater play, to visualize the situation of the gays in Denmark. And here you see the van which transported the group. And we have a small video here from one of those performances in one of the towns of Denmark. The later active years, we have an article in the newspaper Ekstrabladet, and the BBF was at communal election once more in 78 with feminist names. We had a gay film festival at Danish Film Museum, Cinematheque, the first theater manifestation, and the last presence in the Thy summer camp. About the articles in Ekstrabladet, it was a series of articles 5 days during 1 week in January 78 with sensational titles like we whip people with our homosexuality, gays make total sex confusion, and that had lively reactions from the readers. Here's a picture from one of the articles. And about the feminist names in election 78, Nelly Nylon, for example, and the Vandalist. the gay film festival that took place in November, December 1979, with the title Love Between Men in Films, we had films like Jean Genet, Un Chant d'Amour, William Friedkin, The Boys and the Band, Andy Warhol's Lonesome Cowboys, and all performances were sold out. And here you have the program.
Ole, you really are going to have to wind up because you've already had the 15 minutes.
I try to do this, but you make me nervous.
I'm sorry. I have to release for everybody.
You have done your job. There was a delay in the beginning of the technical answer.
No, I took that into account.
Okay. But we can go on maybe now. So the first theater manifestation in September 1980 was a play, Bösemüder, Gay Myths, wanted to discuss five myths. Gays seduce young men. Gays are sodomites. Gays are hypersensitive. Gays are feminine. And gays are promiscuous. And it was illustrated by the five actors that you see here. And our last presence in Thy summer camp 1983 had a motto, very alle mænd er bøsser, which say all men are gay. And this was very provocative. And although this was provocative, the camp was quite relaxed, as you see here. Then we have a notice on AIDS, which arrived at this time, and it made us change our behavior. But many of our friends died after 1983, and it was a very sad period. And you can see here the AIDS quilt, as you may have heard of, commemoration of the dead, and this is as it was exposed in Washington, D.C. About BBF and the culture, the last chapter, just briefly, three examples about theater, Chansonnet, The Maids, shows like Miss World, Frøken Verden, and choirs, Schwanzensängerknaben, which you may have heard sometime. and the mage was played, all the three roles were played by men, as Genet wanted, in fact. At right, you see the two maids, Solange and Claire. And about Miss World, you see here the introducers. It was a show that went on for several years. And here you see the show from 2000 that was shown on Davis public television, in fact. And here are the presenters in silver, and one of the participants, Miss OTB, in blue, gives a good impression of what this show was like. The Schwanzensingerknaben started as a quartet, you're going to see here, and now they're a trio. Yeah, you see them. And now we say at last, what now? Now the situation of gays is better than ever, that's to say in Western countries. But and that's mainly due to work by LGBT groups like BBF, F48, and ILGA, and many others. But we must be aware of backlashes from reactionary groups that can always already be seen in the US and Europe, unfortunately. And we must help gays in other countries in their struggle, especially in Africa and Asia. And this was all. I thank you.
I'm going to suggest we take a 2-minute break because it's hot. I can see people are really feeling the heat. I don't know if we'd be better off opening that door and maybe we can get a breeze come through the room. Would that help? But I think let's take a 2-minute break. People can stand up, stretch, but also think what questions you might want to ask, because we have a huge amount of interesting detail and there'll be lots of questions. Yes, I'm sorry, but that is my job.
I warned you.
I want a question that links the three of them.
But they said in the...
Oh, I love that, Kate. I love the last... The second last sentence.
I know!
The second last sentence has got to be put somewhere, right? I will read it out.
I'm glad someone understood the joke.
Yes. Yeah. Sorry. I would love something that links the three of you, but I can't find something. I mean, I can, and it's going to be too mega theoretical. Well, it would go back to
homonationalism. I mean, yeah, it's because the ending of the last presentation was saved.
Yeah, I know.
Well, let's see.
I want to talk to you.
It's awful to be the chair.
It is not fun. Let me tell you, I don't like telling people to be quiet. But you see, we only have then. There are so many people who will have questions.
So we are prepared for questions.
Yeah, ask people to. Before we start, I have a very important announcement. that I've been asked to pass on. And I will read one sentence very slowly and hope that you share the humour that Kate and I shared. Okay, I have been asked to tell you that there are lots of police around Tiergarten on Brandenburg Tor and around the house where we are. There's an authorised trade union demonstration today, and there are tens of thousands of people on the streets demanding social justice. I will now read what I think is the sentence of the conference. Some police may come into the Ashkeve to use the bathroom. They have nothing to do with us. I couldn't resist that. But can I say, look, I'm not quite sure the best way of doing this, because probably like me, you feel we've had an enormous amount of fascinating detail from three very, very different countries and indeed different historical epochs. So what I suggest is I'd ask, let's ask people, I don't know if anyone has a question for the panel as a whole. Does anyone? I would love to have a question for the panel as a whole. We might come to that. If you have questions for specific people, could you make clear who you're asking the question of? And can I say, as I did yesterday, I'm an Australian, and for us, a question is a sentence which ends with a question mark. If you want to have a long discussion, you'll be able to do that privately with the speakers in half an hour. Okay, so are there any questions? Oh, another announcement. I don't know if any of the police are in this room. If they are, they should listen very carefully, because is anybody uncomfortable with being photographed? If anyone is uncomfortable with being photographed, you might want to leave, I suspect.
Well, no,
Or let the photographer know.
No, I'm not a photographer.
Oh, okay, sorry. I thought you were doing for the conference.
No.
Okay. All right. Any questions for any of the three speakers?
Yes. First, thank you for your presentation. They were really amazing, and I feel a little bit connected with much of, especially the first two presentations, because they deal with something that I'm going to in Colombia about the LGBT, the gay liberation movement in the 70s and the relationship it has right now with the left and with the right, the investigation. So the question is for Hans, is there actually an LGBT group who is critical of the marriage equality and the marriage ban in Taiwan? Like they're active, they're doing stuff, because in the Hispanic world, there is right now a lot of critical pride. So is there anything like that in Taiwan?
Should I answer now? Oh yes, but though there's a very small number of, just a small group. There's a group called Anti-Family Group that have been very vocally critiquing against the kind of normalization of marriage equality campaign. Basically, the campaign started around 2013, and it became massively kind of mainstream. I mean, just everybody talk about love, and love is love, love equals love. I mean, it's good, kind of good PR exercise on part of mainstream gays and lesbian organization, and it also plays, the gay marriage campaign plays a very big part in the rise, further rise of Taiwanese separatism, making Taiwanese people feel, young people especially, they are kind of superior culturally, and more superior to mainland Chinese. And I think the problem I tried to raise in my paper is that it's that the whole campaign kind of is achieved at the expense of continual subjugation of people living with HIV, and they're also, as a kind of civilizing campaign, a it also made people in the LGBT movement forget about all the kind of the state regulation around sex and sexuality. The big crackdown around gay sex partying plays a big part. In my paper, I was talking about the recent criminalization of that prohibit people, pause people barebacking. Imagine two pause guys getting married, and that criminalization could be used to incriminate. It's a divide and rule tactic.
I don't want to cut this off. There may be a follow-up question from that. Does anyone want to follow up on that? Well,
yes. Can I follow up by asking how much is the division between PRC and Taiwan actually play in the legalization of same-sex marriage in Taiwan?
A big division. It's playing Taiwan against China.
Yeah.
Trump in China. I really see the gay marriage campaign as a very, proto fascist kind of campaign, because it refused to face the kind of history in the past as I tried to mediate from the kind of leftist queer intervention around. And it tells the Chinese to fuck off to the kind of 4 million of mainland Chinese came to China, came to Taiwan in 1949. And they've been told by young people to fuck off because the majority of them don't support gay marriage. And young people don't care about the kind of HIV, the kind of refined control of HIV that I talked about. And they think they are, HIV first. In fact, and their core division, they don't really see themselves as Asian. Taiwan look up to the U.S., to the West, to Europe, without relating to its neighbors in Asia, and that's the kind of twisted neo-coloniality that I want to, especially on the part of the elites, that have this kind of hatred for the Chinese, as a kind of hatred for his or her siblings, the kind of self-hatred. But it's kind of thinly covered up by the marriage pride.
Thank you.
Yes, we've got a question. I want to come back to this, so I want to try and link the political background of the three papers in a minute. But yeah, you had a question?
Yeah, the question for the anti-fascist hero. I wonder.
It's not me.
You are now.
I wish.
I wonder how contemporary grassroots anti-fascist activists relate to the problematic polarization of the question. Because although I can understand it very much, I allow myself a sentence to your problem, then I'm also thinking, but what if we leave the interpretation of what history is and remember for anti-fascist resistance, what if we leave it to, in the end, the fascists? Because they will always say, but the leftists, they're all queer, or the queer, they're all leftists, or, so I wonder how the local activists, may be queer or anti-fascist, or queer and fascist, how they relate to it in political practice.
That relates very well to the concerns and problems on how to proceed, which I actually said at the end that I'm still not sure. So I absolutely agree with you. So I'm not saying, and I didn't say at any point, that I don't think we should proceed with any kind of memorialization of him, his, or Captain Marriage, of anyone else. Maybe be discovered in the future. But yes, how to do it?
I unfortunately had a couple of comments from the anti-fascist left saying, well, don't mention it now, it's not the time, it's not the time, it's not the time. Yes, we will acknowledge the fact that it happened, but it's we live now in so delicate times of revisionism, in especially in the Balkans and in the whole of Eastern and Europe in general, that maybe it's not the best moment. I don't agree with that. I think it's the best moment. It's now and always is. But the problem is how to proceed. So for now, I tried, because I've done most of my research is on socialist Yugoslavia, so on the homosexuality after World War II and in the socialist times, where I stressed that we have, yes, the persecution, but we also have the modernization of sexuality under socialism, the decriminalization of homosexuality done in a very modern way without pathologization, at least in the Yugoslav case, etc., etc. So that to be fully, absolutely acknowledge the wrongdoings of the past, but also the good things that came from socialist modernism. That's maybe the easier part, because it's more abstract, and then you have these two things. You have the persecutions and the modernization. The problem with this is that it's that sentence. And then that's the reason, so there's no good part to it. You can't say, hey, yes, but someone opposed this idea, but there were debates and so on and so on. And maybe even didn't say all the details. This that sentence was then copied in other copies and sent to the local battalions on the ground to be read aloud to other soldiers, so for them to be aware what could happen to them if they engage in homosexual activity. There were also executions for heterosexual relationship if they were considered too immoral and spreading venereal diseases. So it's not so easy. It was a Puritan sexual code. The question is, yes, how to proceed? I think first in the LGBT, the local LGBTIQ community, I think which is still not mostly aware of my research on this fighting. So I still haven't really opened the question. And I think better than to proceed with articles, public lectures, which are fine, to go through an artistic path. I think it would be much better than just to say, this happened, let's acknowledge it, and then leave it to whatever happens with this.
Can I? Oh, yeah, I'm going to ask a question of all three of you, but you go ahead, and then I will.
No, I mean, I just had a follow-up question. Mm-hmm. Thank you for your presentation. It was really great, and I responded to this impulse to take this archival material and put it in the hands of an artist or a team to make something of it. But I think this, for me, raises this really tricky, slippery slope when it comes to archival art practices, which is what happens. Would you want that material to stay in a certain region, a specific artist working with it? Are you open to the idea of an artist from, I don't know, Canada, taking this material and making something there? Not to say that that's bad, it's just I'm curious, is this material for you something that you want? Yeah, what is the spread of this material?
Well, as I said, it is one of the few official legal death sentences for homosexuality pronounced in 20th century Europe. We don't have a lot of that. As an official recognized military or civil tribunal, this one is military. So I would like to have also an international recognition of, but I think it is easier. So yes, Canada or Colombia, whatever, it will be very good, but then, of course, you miss the local context, so you have the memorialization of an anti-fascist queer hero point without the Yugoslav part, because I suppose in Canada or in Australia no one really cares if he was or was not Yugoslav. He was just an unsung anti-fascist queer hero, a person that did a lot to fight the fascist and then was sentenced to death by his own fellow fighters and comrades and superiors. And I think it would be very good to have also a path of memorialization in that direction. And that's the reason why I also published about him in English and French, for example. But for the local context, which is, you can imagine, not just delicate, but it's our guide. It's our only guy that we know that was gay in the anti-fascist movement. Of course, there are many of them, but for now there are no accounts or records. So I think on the local Yugoslav, post-Yugoslav Croatian stage, it would be better to proceed with a local artist or performers and so on.
I wonder if I can pull you all away from your very specific topics and think about the fact that we have people speaking from three different countries, all of which are essentially now liberal democracies. So Denmark, of course, has long been not just a liberal democracy, but a country in which the Social Democrats were for a very long time the majority party. Taiwan is a liberal democracy. Croatia now is a liberal democracy, and with Denmark is part of the European Union. And I thought, given the title of this whole panel, it'd be interesting to have you all reflect on whether you think there is a necessary connection between left-wing politics of the sort that people are out on the streets demonstrating for at the moment and the queer movement. Or do you think that, and of course the origin of the Danish movement, as you pointed out, is very connected with that tradition. So do you all think that that connection is still central to when we start talking about queer politics? Maybe start with Denmark and then move to Croatia and Taiwan.
Yes, I think you're right, because now we've just changed our government in Denmark. We have a social democratic government now. I don't know about the ministers, because we were here when it all happened, and there's not written much about this in German papers. But I hope that this will mean that we'll have a more democratic politics in Denmark than we had before, and that movements like ours would be, what do you call it, have better chances to do things. In the time before, we were always connected with the left-wing parties that gained our cause. And that's all what I have to say just now, I think.
We have to tell that we in Denmark also had a conservative government, and the Jewish Minister of Justice was open gay, and he had a black man, too, and it didn't make any obstacles in the television. It was just normally. But we are still in Denmark a little bit behind our sister country, Norway, which is much more liberated than we are on such matter as family, gay who want to have children, and lesbian who want to adopt each other's children. It's free in Norway now, and in Denmark it is still a problem to make gay family with children, and adoption of mother and by mother's right to be in charge of responsibility for the children. So,
And if this is interesting, we had the possibility of getting married in 1989 already. Chris and I were married in 1991, when Barack Obama was the president in the United States, we have had a gay ambassador.
Well, I don't know if that means very much, because the U.S. has a gay ambassador in Germany representing Trump.
And this ambassador, he chose to marry his boyfriend in Copenhagen when he was an ambassador in Denmark, participated at the gay pride march.
The question, though, which I'm now going to throw to you, Frank, is there a necessary connection between left-wing politics and queer politics today? Because I think that's the underlying theme of this panel.
I think so.
I think it is not.
Good, we've got an answer.
I think there is, in a way that, yeah, historically speaking, the left has progressively, with time, that is passing, especially the radical left, and then later also the more moderate left, endorsed or partially endorsed the LGBT rights movement. But on the other hand, the queer movement had strong connections and even dependent on feminist left and so on. So there must be some connection. The question here about memorialization, especially political memorialization, it's, I think, different, because if you find allies in the, let's say, left, and that's the most common thing that happens, especially in Eastern and Central Europe, then the problem of which, for example, when you have all the recognitions of the gay victims of the Holocaust, or Alan Turing in Great Britain, the recognition of the persecution of that state did in the past, which happened in the last 10, 15, 20 years in many Western European countries. The problem in Eastern European countries is that they tend to erase the part, the socialist part, and not from the national narrative, saying that was not us, that was an interruption, a Soviet occupation, or something that we don't share anymore, and we don't have to apologize for what happened under communism. We don't have to acknowledge now, because we don't consider ourselves to have this historical continuation. So when you have acknowledgments from a German government, or a British government, or whatever other government for persecution of homosexuals in the past, it usually connects to the same government that changes time and political parties, and of course acknowledges some more progressive politics. Here the problem with the left is that the current left tends also to distance itself from the communist past, and then say, no, we don't want to acknowledge anything or apologize for anything. It's not our wrongdoing, that these other guys in this other country, and so on. So that's the problem of a memorialization, but of course not in the whole world, I would say Eastern and Central Europe.
Hans, do you want to make a comment?
I think I want to answer the respond more indirectly. I think liberal democracy, I don't have a problem with it. I think, to my knowledge, the gay lib in the 60s also had roots, also in connection with third world struggles and anti-colonial movement. Now, that was in the 60s, and that somewhat kind of died away in the 70s, gradually. But it was very big. It was the gay lib was inspired, and in solidarity, it was kind of demanding greater global equality and justice. As far as Taiwan is concerned, under Cold War division, as an old lefty said, the Taiwanese, their left side has been paralyzed. You know, we don't really have a viable leftist politics because of this, of the global Cold War and the ongoing Chinese Civil War. And so that's that. And liberal democracy, I think, in the case of Taiwan, is a very tricky question, because it's U.S. style democracy. It's the U.S. imperialist style, the democracy implanted onto a place that has not been decolonized from the Japanese. And then that decolonization was kind of blocked away that project of decolonization had been suspended under the Cold War division. So the thing about gay marriages and stuff, I think, you know, you can almost see the kind of the connection between fascism and marriage equality. Because if you place that in a longer kind of history, you see the problem of liberal democracy that's going on in Taiwan.
Does anybody?
And I think
I hang on. Sorry. I think there are other people now want to come in on this. think, yes, you had your hand up, and I think there was someone behind you. No, go ahead.
But me, okay.
Yeah.
So, I mean, my question goes to Christian and Ollie. So, in your historical account, you mentioned that in the park there is this wonderful plaque which says now you have left the heterosexual quarter and there's no way back in five different languages. And this historical reference is very specific, was at least specific in Berlin, and it conjures up a Cold War rhetoric of anti-communism and so on. And also, the fact that same-sex marriage was legalized in 1987, which happens to be another historical coincidence. Would you like to comment on those coincidences?
Shall I?
Yeah.
You are right, there is some connection between sections, and we have wishes us in this camp from West Berlin. And the term of section of this period, West Berlin was a sector in the middle of East Europe. So it gave meaning to leave one sector to another and to symbolize the sympathy between liberation and getting into a special sector, to make a special country for homosexual people to live their life and to all the heroes around to see if you go in here, you are on a foreign ground. This was one thing. And there was another point in your question.
1989, legalization.
Legalization of marriages.
Yes.
Yeah. It came out of a long time with discussion and publishing in television and meanings in newspapers and articles in the daily newspaper about what gay was and what their aims were. And. Especially also, we had a lot of liberalism into different parties from if or the far, the other gay movement.
Mm-hmm.
And there was an atmosphere of that we had to change in the society.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, I think the change came from not socialist government. There was the other one. The opposition had pushed them to do legalizations of that law. So that was the way it happened.
Mm-hmm.
There was a great public support to that.
And there was a committee who ordered a report from two gay people. One of them is here. The other, Henry Beck, who is dead now. And they made a report on the situation of gay people in Denmark. To help the government make the correct laws. And I don't know if you can say something.
You are welcome to employ. But it was a commission who sat down from the government, and they have chosen some scholars, people from the university level. And it was Karin Lützen, and another one, Henning Beck, who is a very famous writer. Unfortunately, he's just died this year. But there was also published in the television as Mrs. and Mr. Homosexual. So it was, you know, it was a very, it was an event. Yeah. And Karin, could you tell something about it? Do you want to tell something?
No. Well, it's just interesting that the Ministry of Justice created this commission in the mid-80s to look into the condition of homosexuals in society, as it was called in the long title. And they were discussing several laws, anti-discrimination law, and that couples could inherit each other. But then at the same time, the parliament started to talk about the partnership law. And the funny thing is that everybody agreed on this partnership law, because they thought that you just filled in a form and send it with by the post. But then, of course, the people of who had something to do with how you make really the laws have said, no, you have to be present. The two people have to be present. So they had to make a ceremony at the town hall. So that they were a little surprised by that. But, yeah.
Thank you.
We have time, yes.
I just do want to add something quickly. You know, I think politics happens in all different ways, and we're talking about big social forces. Mm-hmm. But my friend James, who's a Canadian I met here in Berlin 25 years ago, had a love affair with a guy named Pia, who was from South Africa, and he was doing a postdoc in law. And they went to Hidden City and had a great love affair. Mm-hmm. And then Pia went on to Columbia University, and James missed him, so he followed him. And Pia decided that he wanted to go back to South Africa, and he wanted to do something for this idea of gay marriage, which was kind of a new idea at the time. And James missed Pia. And when James went, he kind of thought, maybe I should do that here in New York. And he got together with a woman named Connie Fess. And they sat down in a conversation. They were going to call it gay marriage, gay this. And Connie came up with the idea of marriage equality. And that was the new term. And they formed a group. And when they went down into the, I used to visit them all the time. They would go into the gay bars and hand out their little flyers. And the gays would say, you're ridiculous. Nobody will ever do that. And James and his organization worked. He actually, when it passed in New York, he spoke at Stonewall. This was something. James right now has just left New York. He is up an hour and a half north of New York. He's opened a little ice cream shop with Connie. They want to do something for the opioid crisis, and so they have a new platform because James has learned meditation and teaches meditation with drugs. I think there are different ways of looking at these stories, and I don't think that the marriage equality movement, I mean, you can look at it from all angles, you can look at it, but many of these things in the marriage equality movement were grassroots that spoke to people, it spoke to people's hearts who wanted them to be partners. And of course, there is the bigger, we can have, I mean, I have a background in political science and from UC Berkeley, we can talk at all different levels, but I think there's a different part to the story.
And I'm going
to
cut you off because we've reached the time limit, and I have one further announcement, apparently, which I forgot in my excitement about the police. I've been asked to get you to please all sign the guest book, which is, I think, at the information desk. I think it was lovely to end with a story, because I think that the story makes the point that every movement in every country has its own particular history. And as I said at the beginning of this session, I think it's wonderful that on the eve of Stonewall, we get so many people coming together to talk about histories in other countries and histories that we don't necessarily know much about. So thank you all, and thank you particularly to our four speakers.